Stephen Greenblatt is a renowned Shakespearean scholar with a gift for writing popular books about arcane subjects, like his recent book about a poem by the Roman philosopher Lucretius and how its rediscovery in a medieval monastery helped launch the scientific revolution. Greenblatt's book, The Swerve, won both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. But as he tells Steve Paulson, Greenblatt first came across this book by Lucretius entirely by accident.
Many, many years ago, when I was a student, I used to rummage around in the bins of used books at the end of the year at Yale. I one day turned up a book paperback for 10 cents called On the Nature of Things by Lucretius, and I was attracted to it because it had a weird, slightly off-color image on the cover of two pairs of legs up in the sky. You couldn't see the torsos doing something. I thought, oh, that's odd. But I saw, of course, that it was an ancient work of physics, and I thought that was way out of my range, but I bought it anyway. And I'm glad I did, because when at some point over the summer I started to read it, I was amazed by it.
So what was so amazing about this book?
Well, for one thing, it's extraordinarily beautiful. It's got absolutely remarkable, passionate visions of Venus and Mars, of dreams of pleasure, of chilling descriptions of plague and so forth and so on. It's just a terrific read. But more importantly than that, I had that experience of discovering the doctrine that said not just that the world doesn't have a providential creator, but that the soul is made up out of the same atoms that the body is made up out of, and that when the body dies, the soul will die as well. That people who couldn't possibly have known this actually did know it about life, about the universe. That thrill of discovering a kindred spirit who lived, in this case, thousands of years ago.
And even about physics. I mean, that's kind of the remarkable thing. I mean, yeah. He's kind of a view of the world as made up of atoms. He wrote this 2,000 years ago.
We don't want to exaggerate. He got a million things wrong by our standards of what's right and wrong. But he came up with an astonishing number of notions that turn out now to be pretty close to what we think is the case, starting, as you say, with the idea that everything that exists is made up out of tiny, invisible particles that are constantly moving, that everything comes into being because it's banging up against each other in experimental ways and coming apart again because it's mutating and adapting.
Now, there are really two stories here. One is the story of Lucretius, this poet-philosopher who lived in ancient Rome and wrote On the Nature of Things. And then there's the rediscovery of the book 1,500 years later. But let's talk first about Lucretius. He was a follower of Epicurus, the great Greek philosopher who's best known for celebrating pleasure as the ultimate goal of life.
Lucretius is not just a follower, but a disciple. He believed that anything that you would create that was decent in life, that was worth pursuing for yourself and for others, depended on maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain for yourself and others.
So Lucretius was widely known back in his day. I mean, many other writers referred to this book, and then it disappeared. What happened?
Well, partly it went under in the general disappearance. There was a huge, massive vanishing of the traces of classical culture. Once the ramparts of the Roman Empire at that point began to crumble, and the Visigoths, the Goths, and so forth began to make their incursions into Rome, people had other things to worry about than public libraries or private libraries, than the copying of books. And of course, the only way this is in a preprint world, the only way things survive is to be copied over and over again. So huge amounts went under. It actually is astonishing that in the early 15th century, the major work articulating this entire vision of the world suddenly turned up. Really, it was as strange as if a flying saucer had come down and landed on Earth and people got out speaking your language and spoke a message for you, but that you could barely understand.
So this takes us to the second part of your story, the rediscovery of this remarkable book by Lucretius. Tell me about the man who found it.
The man who found it was a lifelong papal bureaucrat. He was a poor boy. Poggio Bracciolini, his name was. He was born in 1380. Poggio, as a teenager, came alone to Florence with 5 pennies in his pocket, as he says, and he made his way because he had fantastically beautiful handwriting in a time in which beautiful handwriting was prized. And eventually, he took off and started to look for books. I think it was because he saw that at this moment he could fulfill this lifelong dream of finding the traces of the ancient past. And he starts going to monasteries that haven't been explored yet.
And monasteries were really the repositories of these ancient texts. If anyone was going to save them, it was going to be a monastery.
Absolutely. It's the only game for literacy in town, basically, for centuries. Everything else has collapsed. The schools have all closed. Only the monasteries decided that they would prize books and that they would keep books and that books would be part of the discipline. Reading books and copying books would be part of the discipline of being a monk. In any case, he showed up at a monastery and he was extremely alert to what they might have. And he found a poem that was fantastically beautiful. So the ideas in that poem were regarded as either incomprehensible or wicked or both. But the poetry was beautiful.
Incomprehensible, I suppose, because of the dismissal of the divine. I mean, Lucretius was saying, we don't need the gods. 15th century, we're talking about a world that was entirely dominated by Christian thinking. You almost couldn't think outside that framework.
Absolutely. It was the daily bread of everyone. And what can it mean even for ourselves? It's extremely difficult for ourselves to imagine how it's possible for there to be a universe of such richness and complexity and beauty without someone who's made it as an architect.
And then add to that the fact that Lucretius was an Epicurean, I mean, someone who believed in pleasure above all. And, I mean, this cuts so deeply against the grain of Christian culture at that time. I mean, this was the era when the devout would flog themselves to show their purity.
Absolutely. And the dominant belief was it was suffering that created depth and piety. The pursuit of pleasure was something for a pig, not for a human.
So what happened then once Poggio made this book available? I mean, he circulated it. What kind of reception did the book get?
Eventually, people begin slowly, quietly to talk about it, but carefully, because when you do take it in, if you have a taste for living, you don't embrace these ideas as your own. The greatest philosopher of the 15th century was a Florentine named Marsilio Ficino, who was fascinated by Lucretius and began as a very young man to write a commentary on it. And then at a certain point, he burned that commentary and renounced it because he saw where it was leading. And so it took a very long time, but it's extremely difficult to stamp dangerous ideas out. And it became almost impossible after Gutenberg's invention of the printing press.
What you're really describing is the making of the Renaissance, which to some degree was a reaction against the dominant Christian culture of the time. I guess the question is what role this book by Lucretius played in this new way of thinking.
There are currents from this book that pass like electric currents through some of the figures that are most important to us in the Renaissance. There are currents that pass through Machiavelli. There are currents that pass through the work of the great essayist Montaigne in France. There are odd traces of it in Shakespeare. It is circulating in a kind of careful, canny, disturbing way. And there are very strange, powerful visions of it in places we would not expect to find them, such as Botticelli's great painting of the Primavera, which is very closely based on lines taken from Lucretius. So there are signs of reception. But you had to be careful. The people who weren't careful, and the most spectacular instance is the philosopher Giordano Bruno. Bruno was taken out and burned at the stake. So the question, Steve, is how come these ideas survive given the fact that they are poison to the people at the time? And the answer, at least in part, has to do with that strange thing that we mentioned before, which is that this is a poem. Hmm. It's a beautiful poem. It's this weird moment at which perfectly splendid poetry and science are hand in hand, as they really won't be again, maybe ever, and are working it toward the same end.
Stephen Greenblatt's book is called The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. He talked with Steve Paulson. And that poem by Lucretius? We thought you'd enjoy this excerpt. Substance is eternal. This terror, then, this darkness of the mind, Not sunrise, with its flaring spokes of light, nor glittering arrows of morning can disperse, but only nature's aspect under law, which, teaching us, hath this exordium. Nothing from nothing ever yet was born. Fear holds dominion over mortality only because, seeing in land and sky so much the cause whereof no wise they know, men think divinities are working there. Meantime, when once we know from nothing, still nothing can be create, we shall divine more clearly what we seek, those elements from which alone all things created are, and how accomplished by no tools of gods. Suppose all sprang from all things, any kind might take its origin from anything. No fixed seed required. Men from the sea might rise, and from the land the scaly breed, and fowl full-fledged come bursting from the sky. The horned cattle, the herds, and all the wild would haunt with varying offspring tilth and waste. Nor would the same fruits keep their olden trees, but each might grow from any stock or limb, by chance and change. Indeed, and were there not for each its procreant atoms, could things have each its unalterable mother old? But since produced from fixed seeds are all, each birth goes forth upon the shores of light, from its own stuff, from its own primal bodies. And all from all cannot become, because in each resides a secret power, its own. An excerpt from On the Nature of Things, a poem by Lucretius.